joining us. It's face-to-face therapy. We're here live with Miss Susie Reynolds Reese, which we're going to get into that soon. Well, not get into that. There we go. Here I go.
There
Put
we
my
go.
Foot in my mouth.
There we go.
Other years than mine.
We got Mr. Bradley Phillips
Hello.
Here. Jason Took.
Hello.
Two of my favorite buddies. And we are going to talk about mental health, and we're going to break stigma. And we're going to talk about some other interesting topics. And we thank you for joining us.
Hello.
We are super live.
Yeah.
Like, we are so live right now.
A lot of technology going on.
Lots of technology. Lots of great things. I'm recovering from yesterday.
Yeah, you had a good day yesterday.
I was thrashed. For all of you who do not know what that means, that I went on a hiking trip with Michael Brooks and went kayaking and hiking and kayaking some more and jumping some more. And anyway, let's get to our lovely guest. You're beautiful.
Oh, it's fake. It's all Photoshop.
There's no Photoshop here. I can't afford it.
No, thank you for coming with us today.
Yeah,
thank
seriously.
You. Well, you were surprised. I didn't even know you existed. So it's nice to meet you and know that you're a human
being. I'm actually a real human being. A real
live
human being.
Are you sure about that?
I don't know. Lobbyists and being human sometimes can be a toss-up.
Right.
Sub-human.
I'll take subhuman.
Oh, that's okay. True.
Yep. In this moment or just like always?
Pretty much always. Okay. That's what I mean. A lobbyist, you'll take any compliment you can get. That's,
yeah.
But hey,
he's
a fighter, though.
What kind of fighter?
He's a fighter.
MMA.
No.
Jiu-jitsu,
no.
Kung
no.
Fu.
You know what? The two bills that I'm most proud of you for that I always tell people about.
No.
Yeah. Do you know what they are?
No.
Telehealth. Do you want to tell us a little bit about telehealth?
Yeah. Telehealth has been an issue that I've been working on for 10 years. And we first began about 10 years ago when we wanted to do primary care telemedicine in the state. Mm-hmm. However, our big opposition came from the doctors because for some reason or another, they were worried that they were going to lose their patients. And so mm-hmm. the model of the law is we said you had to be an Arkansas licensed doctor. Mm-hmm. So we had several hurdles that we needed to go over. The doctors wanted us to have a in-person visit first, and then you could have video only teleconference. And so we moved step by step, kind of yard by yard, until COVID finally happened. And we were the last state in the union to fully embrace telemedicine audio only. So that was a really hard battle. And it was kind of frustrating that it took COVID to make it just not an issue at all.
Yeah. But you worked up for 10 years trying to get people access to healthcare that couldn't, because I mean, we're in Arkansas.
52% of our people do not have broadband.
Yes, thank you. Or we don't get into vehicles, all that. Almost everybody has an iPhone now, though. Right. And can do telehealth and see their doctor now, thanks to people like you.
Thank you.
I would touch you, but I don't know you.
Okay. Oh, I forgot to ask consent.
Yeah,
I forgot. We had a conversation. I've got to get better at that.
It's just best to always ask first. I say that because his hair is so soft.
I agree. You should smell it. It smells wonderful.
I did that. He hugged me earlier and it touched my face. And I just instinctually had to touch his hair because it's so soft. And then I apologized immediately because that's not okay to do.
Well, you know, if he really thinks you're special, he'll give you a lock. He does that.
Yeah.
What? That's
kind of crazy. You get to pick the face or the back.
Oh, like I didn't say face hair or back
well,
hair.
We decided yesterday that Jason is party in the front and party in the back.
Jason's all party. Jason's just all party, man. Just, his DNA test says 100% party.
Party animal. Party human.
Yeah. Party subhuman.
So let's get down to some. Well, this, you know what? I do like this, that we can joke and talk about serious things. And that's one of the million reasons I like to do this, is to talk about things in a comfortable setting when the topics are usually kind of uncomfortable,
yeah,
right?
They don't bother me anymore.
Yeah. You're good. So how do they not bother you anymore, Susie?
Well, it started unintentionally. And then I guess just who I am as a person is mm-hmm. just part of who I am. Because your best relationships, you've normally had some type of uncomfortable conversation.
It's
and
true.
That deepens that relationship. And mm-hmm. quite frankly, I'm tired of being superficial. So, mm-hmm. And I mean, we all have those moments where we're, how are you? I'm fine. You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But those vulnerable moments, that's where growth happens and that's where connection happens. Mm-hmm. And when we're uncomfortable about things, most of the time it's because we don't know enough about it, or there's something in there that makes us remember something that we didn't like. Mm-hmm. And so it's an opportunity for growth. And many people don't like that thrown in their face. But
that's kind of like something that we learned in communications called conflict theory. A lot of people think that conflict breeds intimacy. So it's kind of the whole, let's have a fight and then make up. Mm-hmm. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes you got to get into the nitty gritty to find out who people really are and how they really feel.
Sometimes I think when you have that conflict, at least for me, I kind of have to make a mental decision. Like, do I want to stay friends with this person? Is this going to be worth it? Like, because I'm pretty close off. Point. Like with the people who are closer to me. And if there is a conflict, because I'm kind of like you, Susie, like I'm not going to not say something, right?
Well, and I'm not saying that there aren't times where you have to pause or process or do whatever. But at the same time, for me in a relationship, there are definitely layers. And I have a lot of no-go zones with people that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that they can't ever get there. But, you know, there's certain spaces in my world that belong to me.
Yeah.
And I have every right to have control over who I allow into those spaces. Mm-hmm. That's for my own sake and it's for their sake as well. But in those moments of conflict, depending on the situation, mm-hmm. Do I want to say the thing? And then what's the result of that?
Right.
Because if it's someone that you've invested a lot of time and energy in, sometimes mm-hmm. you say the thing and it's better in mm-hmm. the end. Sometimes you say it and then you don't talk for a while.
Right.
And that doesn't mean it's a forever not talking, but there are always going to be people that aren't going to be a part of our worlds for whatever purpose. I saw something a while back that said that 30% of people we meet will not like us. And then we won't like another 30% of people that we meet. So there's 60% right out the window. So just go for that 40% and you're winning. And I was like, hey, I like these numbers. That makes me feel a lot better. It takes a lot of stress off of me as a human being because not everybody's going to like me. And I cannot control that.
Yeah.
Whatsoever.
Yeah.
So stop putting energy into it.
I like that.
I think there's a big difference too between arguments and discussions. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times we argue when we should just be discussing. Like this, I think, is a wonderful discussion. Mm-hmm. And when you just share ideas and you share vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Rather than be defensive and then just argue your point of view and not listen to the other person, I think the discussion is more about listening and sharing.
I think sometimes, though, people don't like what you have to say in your discussion, and that's when it turns into an mm-hmm. argument, and that's where it becomes emotionally charged. I think probably arguments are more emotionally charged and discussions are more fact-based.
Sure. Yeah, things get triggered. Like she was saying, maybe it's triggered something that's happened to you in your past. I'll go into like my brain, go into my brain. No, but like those synapses that hold trauma that we're not even aware of get triggered by a tone of voice, an action, a movement, whatever. And it's like we're in defense mode before we even process what the person said cognitively.
And it makes it very hard in relationships because sometimes you don't give this person a fair shot because something happened to you in the past and mm-hmm. they do something that reminds you of that. So a lot of times you take that baggage with you and that's awful to do.
Some of our biases, like, I don't know, maybe people might be biased against you because you're a lobbyist.
It's happened.
Or a female.
Even, I've never heard
or
of these lobbyists.
Or a minority. Female.
What's your favorite one?
Don't tell my mama I'm a lobbyist. She thinks I'm a piano player in a whorehouse. And my actually favorite one is lobbying is the second oldest profession on earth, but not as highly regarded as the first. those are my favorite lobbyist jokes. So back to your trauma.
I'm sorry. I'm done.
It's okay.
Am I inflicting trauma?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Back to the show.
Let's turn this over to the actual woman who gets paid for public speaking.
Sometimes.
We're not paying you, are you?
Tell us.
They said you had the checkbook today. Right. Yeah. Went he reached for the wall.
I'm real good at paperwork, I promise.
You are if you tried to get any falls through. Patience and paperwork.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite thing to speak about? What do you normally like? What's your topic that's yours? Like, what do you consider yourself an expert at?
Nothing.
What do you consider yourself really, really good at?
Nothing.
Okay. Do you do stuff?
I do stuff. I'm doing stuff right now. So I speak a lot about suicide. People often say that I'm an expert, whatever that means, in suicide prevention and the realm of suicide. That. Yeah, I'd rather not be an expert, quite honestly. I do know quite a bit, I would say, and I speak about it quite often, although it's not my favorite thing to talk about all the time. I'd much rather do stand-up comedy, but for some reason, people don't often call me for that, so...
And you probably don't throw a lot of stand-up comedy into your suicide.
Oh, you do? I do throw a lot of humor in there. You know, it's weird because I'm allowed to put humor in the suicide prevention, but when I've like gone on stage to speak as a comedian, which it hasn't really happened, this is just a, you know, theoretical, but when you open with, I do suicide prevention, it doesn't land as many jokes for some reason, you know.
I could imagine that.
So I speak about a lot of stuff. I did two yesterday for nurses from mid. One was on self-care and one was actually on tertiary trauma.
We talk a lot about self-care here. What can we have some of your bullet points?
Of my self-care conversation. Yeah. So I actually started with the concept. I do have a structure to how I build my content. And I typically talk about history or definitions, things like that. And then, so essentially ask what people think of when they think of self-care. And we often think of the pinnacle of pamper, right? Mm-hmm. Massages and beaches and all of these things that often cost a lot of money or resources or time that most people don't often have the ability to access. So I tried to restructure it and look at a foundation and the components of what self-care really should be when it comes to a whole person. So spiritual, physical, mental, emotional, psychological, whatever that looks like to you, as well as financial and cultural pieces, and talk about those bases and how essentially self-care is creating support systems. And then as we are able to get past our survival mode, which many people are in right now, we start getting into an opportunity to thrive. And that's when you can start to try and think beyond, what do I need to be okay right now? Mm-hmm. So that's when you can start to try and build towards that pinnacle of pamper.
I kind of latched onto the idea of self-care several years ago before it was called self-care, when it was Stephen Covey's seventh principle. Do you know what that is?
I've heard of Stephen.
Sharpen the saw. And that is based on the idea that the saw does not get sharpened by you laying it down and it's sitting there. You have to actually physically sharpen the saw. And so laying there and doing nothing doesn't actually recharge you. Doing things that make you feel good, which I think now we're calling self-care.
He's gone on to me about this sharpening the saw thing numerous times.
So I think the two are related. Do you agree or do I mean,
so I think that definitions are difficult when it comes to things like this, because that could fall under resilience as well. And a lot of times people say phrases that they don't not naturally understand to have any kind of attachment to something. So we say resilience a lot and people think bounce back. Technically, there's not an agreed upon definition for that word, though. And when we look at resilience as a practical thing, that's absolutely it. Sharpening the way that we think, the way that we work, trying to improve ourselves so that we are more streamlined, better at what we do. People think in those terms when it comes to being practical and what they're doing, but when they're trying to connect these concepts, it doesn't always work that way. For me, self-care is beyond just our ability to be better at what we're doing and good at what we're doing physically, whatever. Sometimes you have to have those moments to disconnect. When it comes to children and processing information, recess is actually the most important part of their day because they disconnect from what you're trying to fill their brain with, and they have fun and they have opportunity for creativity. And that's when their brain is like sparking. And that's when their brain is actually processing that information. So the more that we take recess away from them, we actually limit their ability to connect with that information. But balance is everything. Taoism talks a lot about that. So I think that it's all about sharpening, but knowing also when to sit it down because my arm is tired. And if we don't have that opportunity for growth when we work out, that's not when our muscles are building. It's when we're resting.
Recovery.
That's a good way.
Yeah, I like that. That's a very, very great analogy.
So I've always been told that people commit suicide whenever they have too great social attachments or too few social attachments. Can you tell us maybe about some of the leading causes of suicide that we can help watch out for?
So we could talk all day about that. I think that part of that theory of what you're talking about stems from Emil Durkheim, who is considered one of the fathers of suicidology. And he does talk about connection and detachment. There are actually four different types of individuals that he classifies and reasons behind them. So he did a sociological study and essentially said that these are all the things that we see when it comes to people who were dying by suicide. He was French. And I want to say that this was in maybe the 1800s. It might have been 1600s. I'm not a fan of the numbers. So, oftentimes we try to classify people, but as we've learned more and more about suicide, we've had different ways of classifying suicide. So most of the time we look at intention, you know, did someone intend to die? And that's how we classify it. But for causes and things that contribute to it, it can be a lot of things, and it may have nothing whatsoever to do with their relationships or connection. But we do see that as one of the most commonly occurring risk factors. And we do know that relationships often are that triggering or stimulus incident that creates that crisis situation for an individual, but not always. So gender-wise, men tend to be more socially motivated or financially motivated. And when they lose those things, they often have resulting suicidal intention after. For women, and this is, of course, generalizations are always dangerous. Stereotypes are always dangerous. But as far as research, and as far as research and the numbers, and if we're looking at it from that science side, then we know that when it comes to women, they are more relationally and emotionally connected to others. And that tends to be a driving factor for them, of course. When you start looking at minority groups, marginalized groups, you have other factors that layer in on top of that, access to care now, whereas in the 1800s, no one had access to care, right?
Right.
So of course, you know, things change, and as technology and access and even understanding changes, we see some shifts in those reasons behind. But I still think that a happy, whole person doesn't ever have the same types of suicidal issues as those who are struggling and have no ability to get to the care that they need.
Especially depression.
Well, and again, you know, a lot of people will say depression and suicide are, I believe, and this is my personal opinion, that suicide should be its own category. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that depression and suicide always go hand in hand.
No,
either way.
They don't go hand in hand, but a lot of people who suffer from depression also
can, but not all, right?
Thoughts of suicide.
And the same with anxiety or any other mental health issues. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the therapeutic components of care, a lot of times people focus on the depression piece and they may completely overlook the suicidal piece.
Yes, that is a very, very big problem with practitioners.
Yes.
And I mean, practitioners, not just therapists, but medical doctors, nurses, CNAs, anyone, maybe first responders. Obviously, they haven't had your assist training, though, if they are doing that. But assist training and a lot of those skills-based trainings that you give to first responders now.
So I don't think that that's the ideal program for first responders. I think it's a great program.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great program for certain types of roles. But really, in those situations, they're already in a crisis point.
Right.
And at that point, that skill set, other than the ability to actually know the components of a plan and how to like mentally take note of that, you know, they need additional skills beyond just that.
But it's most people don't even ask about it.
Right.
Well, you know, like if you go into your typical health checkup for your PCP and sometimes even therapy, suicide's never even discussed.
No, you're right.
It's depression, your anxiety. I get people refer to me every single day for depression and anxiety, and nobody has even asked them about thoughts of suicide.
Well, and I think too that that's a fear factor even in our practitioners, because I've had many reach out to me and ask what to do, and I'm thinking, you're supposed to be the one the to be doing this. Yeah. And I get in trouble for that because, you know.
Why do you get in trouble for that? Oh, because like you tell
truth.
Them?
Yeah. Oh, people like the truth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we get that a lot, too.
Well, yes, I've definitely got some opinions about that. And if you are a practitioner and you don't think that suicide is something that you could handle, then maybe you need a training or stop being a practitioner.
Yeah. Well, they don't want to hear that either.
Yeah.
So I actually posted, I don't know when it was on Facebook not long ago about someone had went to see a therapist. Mm-hmm. They said that their, whomever it was, I can't remember mm-hmm. who she lost, was selfish. And that was the end of the conversation. And I'm sorry, but I lost a little bit. So, because, you know, that we're constantly talking about, you know, stigma and how we are going to tear stigma down. And yet in these spaces, we are doing more to perpetuate stigma than anyone else.
In some places, yes.
Right. And so it's important that, like, if you go to a mental health professional, that they not be perpetuating these stigmas.
I agree.
And some of it has to do with education. Some of it has to do with old school mentalities. Mm-hmm. Some of it has to do, again, with, like, I've had a thing and I feel guilty or I feel responsible. And so this is the barrier that I put up so that I don't have to realize that really there was nothing that you could have done about it. Mm-hmm. So forgive yourself and let's learn and move forward from it.
So having seen what you've seen and studied and the knowledge that you have, what are the conversations that we should be having right now? What are some things we should be talking about?
You know, I think that's a really broad question as
It was broad intentionally.
Yeah, I feel like that the fact is that we do not communicate well as human beings at all. We have all of these methods of communication. We have all these platforms and all this access, and yet we do not speak openly about real things. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. So for me, I think that just learning basic communication styles, like, you know, I like to go and every few days I have to have a bath. If I don't have a bath, it's not good for me. I feel tension build up in my body. And if you know that, you can check in on me. You seem a little stressed out. You know, have you
been able to
relax? And no, I haven't. Well, why not? That's a much easier conversation than I'm worried about you. I think you're suicidal. Right? Let's build up before we get to that point. And yet we don't do that. We wait until it's in a crisis situation. People in a classroom don't even want to say the word suicide. Mm-hmm. I have to constantly talk about it in a very almost demeaning way with people, because if we can't even say that word, how are we ever going to address it? Mm-hmm. If you can't even like say it in a sentence and not cringe as you're saying it, how are you going to help someone that needs you? So if that's where we are with that word, then let's do something on the front end before we even get there. Let's build into it. It's the same thing you would do in healthcare. You know, you don't just throw someone in out of nowhere, but that's our expectation most of the time. So I think part of it is communication. We also have to have more vulnerable moments with one another and say, you know, when you ask how I'm doing, I'm very honest and people don't know what to do with it most of the time. Like right now I'm doing well, so I can say that. But when I'm not doing well, they're like, did you just say you're not good? Because that's what we say. I'm fine. I'm good. Everything's okay.
So are you supposed to be the, like in your circle and your friends, are you the one that's always supposed to be good?
No. They know I'm a hot mess. Okay. Yeah. Like I have my moments where I'm not, you know, like thankfully I'm not right now, but yeah, I know. And I have two very good friends that we just call each other on it, period. And it's never in a mean spirited way. It's just, you know, you're not doing what you need to be doing for yourself. And I care about you and I'm going to say it and I'm going to stand beside you no matter what you choose to do with that information. And I'm going to love you, but I need you to know that I worry about you too. And I think that if we had more people like that, less people would feel the way that they do right now.
Because you are connected and you have a relationship with them. And even at the smallest level, we still need human connection and relationships.
Well, but also I do my very best. I do judge. Don't get me wrong. There are some people that are in my 30% and we're just not going to connect. But when you're in my circle, like tell me whatever you need to tell me. I'll check in on you. I'm not going to change how I look at you whatsoever. And I don't think that we do that the way that we should do that.
Jason, I think you have some questions too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a few.
Yeah. Let's hear one.
Is this Jason Toops B. Brown?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What motivates you?
Food. Oh, sorry. That was the speed round answer. Yeah. Food. Also, I'm going to die one day. So I want to do something while I'm here.
I like that. Mm-hmm. Not that you're going to die one day, but that you're making life meaningful.
Oh, I appreciate it. I was like, hey, what?
The second part was awesome.
Well, I hate to tell everyone we're all going to die. So,
okay. I think we've kind of addressed this a little bit. And just so thinking societally or universally, what is something that we could do to make life better? So then I would say maybe suicide isn't as prevalent. Or I think a lot of times, I think about this often, we focus so much on the, I call it the goal line, the goal line defense of don't take the gun out of your hand, go to the emergency room, call 911, don't kill yourself today. Versus, and in psychology, we focus so much on what's wrong with everybody and the disorders versus the happiness and the good things with humanity. So I guess overall, and I think about maybe looking at what can make life better mm-hmm. versus just how not to kill myself today.
Positive interventions.
So yeah. How do you think
it's still life intervention could be better? Is in yeah. that intervention phase. I think first of all, most people are not doing true prevention mm-hmm. and prevention is before we ever get there. I think it's different for me than what I would say as a whole. For me, it's just being able to be weird and laugh at myself and have humor because I need those moments more than anyone will ever understand. So for me, it's about the reality that everyone's a hot mess. I don't care what your Facebook feed looks like, how photoshopped it is. You're a hot mess too. Join the club. We're all a hot mess. It's fine. It's just what kind of hot mess are you, right? And instead of doing this comparative, like positive, like perfect lifestyle, let's just admit that we're weird. And sometimes you're doing something, you're like, that's weird. You know, it happens, right? But as far as suicide goes, you know, we've put it over here in this, it's not perfect, it's hard, it's difficult, and I don't like it. So I'm going to stick it over here when it's like, it's a part of it. That's a part. It should be in the mix. It's going to be in the mix. Mm-hmm. And until we can just accept that people struggle because we're human beings and life sucks, you know, but we also have to find the humor in stuff. And
Misery
we have
to, company.
Yeah, I mean, And I love stand-up comedy. That's one of my ways to decompress. That's one of my self-care strategies. And Daniel Sloss is one of my top favorites. And he says that humor doesn't exist only in the happy moments. Humor exists in every moment. We've all been in those situations where life has been at its worst mm-hmm. and you start laughing uncontrollably, almost like maniacally. And it's the best release ever. And it's not that you're happy in that moment, but you find humor because it's necessary. In fact, there's a lot of research that shows that there's actually proteins in our tears, not only when we cry, but when we laugh and cry, mm-hmm. that is being released because our body is trying to get rid of toxins. Our body is actually using that humor to heal us, and we're not doing it enough. And I'm not talking about like, obviously, major mental health issues. You can't. Some people do sit and laugh, and that's fine, but that's not my, I'm not saying that that's a medication. I just think that we're all taking ourselves far too seriously.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think that's Western society in general, is when we focus this around like a work day or whatever, versus focusing on what makes us happy or fulfilling or purposeful in life.
More like, these are the 8 hours a day that I'm unhappy, and I cannot be happy until 5 o'clock. It's here kind well, of we schedule funny. Emotions for ourselves throughout the day.
I totally love the humor and I try to be funny. I'm told that I'm not funny, but
very funny.
It's tricky because people come to me, they're usually very sad. And I've had other clinicians come in or they've been to other people. Like I tried to talk to my partner about this deep, sad issue, and they laughed it off. And that can be super demeaning and hurtful.
Well, and that's not what I'm saying whatsoever. I'm just saying that as a human species, that we need to be able to just accept that we are a flawed mess.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But in those moments of true vulnerability, we also have to be willing to lean into that.
Totally.
And I think that it makes people uncomfortable because mm-hmm. they feel like you're going to pull them into it, or they feel like it's going to acknowledge something in them that's also flawed. Mm-hmm. So we have mm-hmm. to just say, like, I'm a hot mess. I have my things. I have my moments. And there are definitely times when I just have to do what I need to do. Mm-hmm. But when I can, let me be there with you in whatever it is that you need me to be in there, that with you.
Yeah, like I laughed so hard yesterday, my face hurt. And I need that. And I was like, I need this like once a month.
Yeah,
like,
we don't. We do not.
I prescribe laughter every day.
Yeah, yeah, you're good at it. You are so good at it. But I think we all have to get better about it. Yeah, because I think it goes the other way from what I said. So I think people overthink things, especially with people with anxiety. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are very anxious, especially now. We overthink it. So we want to ask about suicide, but we don't want to ask for suicide. We want to make a joke, but we don't want to make a joke. Or we don't want to be offensive, or you know what I mean? It gets very like,
I have some inappropriate jokes that I'm not going to say in front of the camera, but the thing is that there are places and spaces where you can do these things. Sure. And when you know certain people yeah. and you have that rapport, then that's an okay space. It's not okay to say on Facebook Live where everyone's going to misunderstand and we don't have that relationship. But mm-hmm. there's definitely, right. I mean, we hear gallows humor all the time. Mm-hmm. That's necessary to mm-hmm. process what they are experiencing. And I'm not saying it's appropriate. It's not appropriate most of the time, mm-hmm. but it's necessary, yeah. you know? And I think that that's where there's so many different layers of understanding that many people don't have. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming at the world from what they know. And we all just have to admit, I don't know everything. I don't know your life. I don't know your life. I don't know your life. Mm-hmm. And your experience is valid. Your perspective is 100% valid. You are here. You exist like 99.9% of the time without me. So I can't tell you that you're wrong, you know?
So leaning into a little bit of that discomfort, would you like to address Asian hate?
I'm not uncomfortable with it as far as like, you know,
we probably all are.
Well, I'm sure you are.
Let's be real. You know yeah. what I mean? Like it's something that I'm dying to know more about, and I don't want to be offensive. But I want to be helpful, right? Because we talked off camera about some other experiences I've had. But I'll admit, like, I'm nervous. I'll screw it up.
Well, and I think that
most people are.
But that's yeah. because you don't know.
Right.
And when you come at it from, I don't know and I want to know.
Yeah.
That's very different than I don't know and I don't want to know
right.
because I'm right. And so that's where that's very harmful. And I think that mm-hmm. it's all in that how you're looking at it and mm-hmm. how willing you are to listen right. because you will never know. Let's
true.
Be honest. You're never going to
yes.
know.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, being aware can really open up a lot of opportunities because mm-hmm. People are like, how have you been? I'm like, I didn't go anywhere last year. And they laugh, you know, I'm like, literally didn't go anywhere because I was afraid. And then it changes that conversation again, mm-hmm. because I was fearful that people would see me and not know who I was. And I did have a couple incidents that happened that nothing major, thankfully, but it's just a not knowing any better situation. Mm-hmm. I did several news things over the past several months about Asian hate, and the comments were horrible. And I know better, but the comments were horrible. And I thought that's the problem, because here I am being very authentically yeah. me telling you that this is a problem
yeah.
and you're mocking and dismissing and encouraging these types of behaviors. So what is in you that's making you do that? Mm-hmm. And that's when the problem is, because people don't want you to judge or, you know, point, but mm-hmm. that's not what we're doing. Like, why can't we be better about it? Mm-hmm. So
my major question, and at the risk of being ignorant, is, you know, we live in Arkansas. And so I like to think that if somebody hates somebody, we're going to know about it. And I don't know anyone in my circle. I haven't heard anybody out. I haven't heard anyone in the South talk about hating Asian people. And so where is this? Where's it going on?
It's like happening everywhere.
Okay.
It is happening everywhere.
So
every time I see it, it's in New York or Chicago or something like that.
I need to again say that I'm pretty frank, and I'll just address it. But at the same point, you know, sometimes it's taken the wrong way, and I don't mean it that way. I want to help. So I think that part of the issue is that many people have this belief that there isn't any racism. And I'm not a fan of that word because it's so off-putting to some people. and they immediately stop listening, right? But I have been in situations and I have been in spaces where people have frankly told me, I'm okay because I'm not this or because I'm not that, right? You're not Black, so you're okay. You're not white, so you're okay. Both sides of the fence, right? That's not acceptable. It's just not. It's not okay. And I know that. And I know that that's happened multiple times. That's not me just saying this anecdotally. Like, that's literally happened to me. I've had people that I've dated where I was concerned about meeting their family because I know how they felt about other races. And I was told that it's okay because you're not this, right? So I think sometimes we don't see it openly, but we know it's happening. And we have been in those spaces where it has happened. And yet it hasn't been something that's really caught our attention. I think a lot of times it comes, it happens, it's said, and then you laugh, you joke, whatever, right? And I'm not saying everyone's done it, but I know that I've been in situations like that. And as a minority, I've definitely not been in as many of those situations when they were predominantly or 100% one race or another having that conversation, right? So for me, I know that that's happening. I don't believe that most people are walking around with a shirt on that says, I hate Asian people, but I know that it's there. And then we have a lot of rhetoric that's happened and people are very keen on talking about politics and politicians. I don't care who said it, it's happened and it's historically based. So people have often over time since especially the 1800s talked about how Asians had carried diseases. They were disease ridden. We were called yellow pests, yellow peril, all kinds of things. And so when you have language that comes out calling things Kung flu, China flu, then there's this thing that happens in someone's head where you're the cause of it, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when they're uneducated, especially when they don't know any better, right? And so they associate us with this thing. Now, everyone has a feeling one way or another about COVID, and I'm not having a debate on that. But when you have fear of an intangible, and then you're given a tangible thing to fear that caused it, where are you going to direct your fear? Because we can't direct it at this germ, but we can direct it at a human being, can't we? So I believe that's a lot of it and what we've seen. I've had incidents where I thought I was being followed in the store. I get stared at a lot. I have always gotten stared at a lot in the store. Okay. I don't know exactly why. We can have, we can have a million conversations, but used to it was just part of it, right? Now, I don't know if I'm being stared at for the same reasons I used to get stared at, or if it's because I'm Asian. And so in my head, I'm constantly thinking, am I safe here? And it's very uncomfortable to wake up and to walk out the door and wonder, are people looking at me for this reason or for another reason, right? So that's constantly rolling. I've had situations where people recognize that I'm not white or not Black, and they've physically gotten up and walked away, or they physically have, you know, I mean, it's very uncomfortable situations. Luckily for me, nothing physical, like violence related has happened, but it's not just in New York. It's not just in California. It's constantly happening every day. There was a teacher, they found his body a few days ago. Two of his students had murdered him and dumped him in the dump. A woman has recently was beheaded and they found her body, and I could go on and on and on. And we know that this is continuing to happen. The only reason it got any media attention whatsoever was because of Atlanta, and it's gone quiet again. And it's really, really frustrating, because if you're looking at Asian communities, if you're reading anything by any leaders in our communities, we are all telling you this is still happening and it's still a really big problem. But until something major happens again, it's not going to get that national level news like it did with Atlanta.
I get clients that come in, I would say weekly, of different ethnicities and minorities that have had some really severe racial things said and done to them right here in this community in Conway, working at big organizations, shall I say, that it should not be acceptable, but it's happening.
Well, as a woman, and I can't speak for every woman, but I don't believe that other women are addressed in the same way that I am about my anatomy. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that men come up to them and immediately ask them very inappropriate questions right off the base about their anatomy mm-hmm. because of their race. Mm-hmm. I've had that happen more times than I can count. I've had many men tell me, I've never dated an Asian before. And I love to say, well, it's not about to start. So it's not, you know, that's not how you win with me. It's just not going to work.
Oh,
so,
come on. That doesn't work.
Hey, I haven't checked your box before.
Unfortunately for you.
Hispanic, Caucasian, and other. Yeah. But no.
See, that never happens to you, does it?
No.
Jason, never. Maybe.
Never dated a hippie before. Hippie, military.
Yeah. Hippie, military.
So wait, you're telling me that really was just me. All right. I'm
Well, I like how we have moved our conversation from what I thought it was going to be about suicide prevention, which we touched on that, to other things.
Which never happens here. We never move around the topics.
I never get distracted.
We never circle back.
Yeah. Circle back. Circle back.
Nobody here likes to be in a box, right? No.
No.
Did we hit all your questions?
Did it just?
Oh, I got speed.
There's always plenty going, more. Man.
Yeah.
Going.
So, okay, let's talk about verbiage then. So what would be, so in being ignorant, what would be the way to refer to just the Asian population or Asian as a group?
We're going to do some education for our listeners right now.
So first of all, I laugh in my head. It's like there's something that happened and that's why I'm laughing. And then people say they think I'm laughing at them. It's not what's happening. So Asia is a country or a continent. My bad. I messed that up. Asia is a continent and it's very large. I don't know if you guys have ever seen a map. There's like seven of them.
It's the largest one, right?
Right. Exactly. It's the largest one. So within that continent, there are like 48 countries and all of them are very different from one another. Like very different.
Different language, different culture.
Yes. Russia is in Asia. So technically Russians are Asian as well. Oh my gosh. Mind-boggling.
Don't let them know.
No, I won't let them know. Afghanistan is in Asia. So technically, they are also of Asian descent.
Southwest Asians.
Right.
Yeah.
So South Asians, Indians, you have East Asians where my heritage is from. And most of the time when people use the word Asian or Asia, they are referring to East Asians, which pisses everyone else off. Okay.
Okay.
Because they're like, I'm also from there, sort of, you know, on the large scale. So why do I get ignored all of the time? So a lot of people are always saying it's not just East Asians. We're talking Chinese, Korean, Japanese. That's often the pinnacle of what we think of when we use that phrase. So to say Asian American means a lot of people from a lot of different places. Now, the long phrase is Asian American Pacific Islander. And I think Biden recently changed it to add also Hawaiian in there as well.
Why did they get their own? Why, I always wondered that. It's like Asian and Pacific Islanders.
We can ask Sharon about that because Sharon is...
A lot of I believe has to do with the geography, but also the history of how people came over here. And so it's more or less there's a similarity in experience, even though it's not right. Filipinos were actually the first Asian Americans to come to this country back in like the 1500s. But most people think of the Chinese when they were doing the Chinese Railroad. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it has to do with lack of education. So I cannot speak for all of the other people of Asian descent. And it's best that I not try because I'm not of that background. But, you know, most of us are accepting of AAPI, which is just the shortened Asian American Pacific Islander phrase, because that's a huge mouthful. And then, of course, you know, some individuals would prefer to be recognized as their country that they act. So if you're South Asian, you might prefer to be called Indian. It's personal preference. And I think that when you have a rapport with someone, that's a completely acceptable conversation to have and say, you know, I don't want to offend you. How would you prefer that I acknowledge you, if at all? Right. And like earlier, you asked, where am I from? And I made a joke about it because we often get, where are you from? And it's not like, what town are you from? Which is what you were right, asking. Like, yeah. Mostly it's like, what kind of Asian are you? It's what they're saying. And I'm like, I don't even know your name, John. Can we at least get to second base first? You know, like, what's, I don't understand this. And if you're only asking me, if we're in a room like this and I'm the only person you ask that question, that's where the problem lies. Yeah. Because if you're not saying, well, where are you from? And where are you from? And why am I different? Okay. I want to be treated just like anyone else. Mm-hmm. And if it's a natural kind of thing, then that's perfectly fine. But every single one of us who looks a little different, we are all tired of that. We are all very exhausted by answering it. And many of us, especially those in the Asian diaspora, which is what it's called, essentially there are lots of people from lots of places that end up in lots of different places. We actually would rather, you know, that someone just kind of not ask that question for the most part, because it's not about that. It's about me as a human. It's me as Susie, right? Not me as, you know, whatever. And if I want to share my background, I'm like, isn't that something you do organically anyways as a human? Like, are you cool? Okay, they're kind of cool. You want to kind of hang out? Yeah. And then you learn more about somebody. And it's like a progression that happens, not like a, give me all the answers now. I want to know. Like, I'm always like CIA. Like, what are you going to use this for? Is this for the fraud? Like, what's the... I don't have any money. So that's not one of my answers on my password. Okay.
So we've pretty much established that you're very funny.
Oh, am I?
So what are some of your favorite questions that you get and your favorite responses that you give them?
I have so
it seems
many.
Like you've got some canned ones that are pretty good.
I have a lot. I have a lot of things that I say consistently in certain situations because it just kills, excuse my pun, every time. So that was inappropriate. Facebook is definitely going to
totally appropriate.
Attack me for that. Yeah. Don't worry,
we're used to it. Yeah. So just join the crowd.
So I think the last live event I did, like in-person event I did, I someone said something about, out of the crowd asked me a little bit about my heritage essentially. And I said it just immediately, and I wasn't even thinking, I'm from my history is from Korea, South Korea, not North Korea. And then everyone laughed, which doesn't always happen because some people actually think that North Koreans just get out and walk around the world free life. Normally, if they're from North Korea, they have written a book and there's a documentary and they have lots of money because they are not just free walking around. So I do that a lot. A lot of racially just, and it's funny because a lot of people that aren't Asian will just be like this, the whole like, do I laugh? And like, it's funny for me because I make you guys uncomfortable. So yay me.
Okay. So there's this guy in England.
Yeah.
And he's such a BTS fan.
Oh.
That he completely had plastic surgery.
Yeah, he's angry at the Koreans.
And now he is claiming that he has transitioned into being Korean. What are your thoughts? I mean, he says that he is transracial. And that's a thing. He was born in the wrong body.
I think I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about. And I think that they are a non-binary individual who has also saying that they're transracial. So they are saying that they're now Korean because they've had several surgeries, including eye surgery, in order to make themselves look like a particular K-pop star. K-pop's Korean pop. It's a really big deal. I don't know how I feel about it. It's a little confusing to me, to be honest. I'm not super into K-pop. So I'm just it's always weird to me when people want to be like someone else to that extent, you know? And so I don't know enough about this individual to know like their background and all of that. But I will say that all of the South Koreans are very angry. And that's one group of people you should never miss off. I'm just saying.
They're angry that he's done.
Well, they're angry because, you know, culturally, you can't steal someone's culture.
Super appropriation.
Yeah. And people, I'm not going to say white people, but to do it a lot, they take things that aren't necessarily theirs, and then they break them into pieces, and then they sell those pieces off and make money off of it, when most of the time, the thing that they're taking has some type of racial trauma attachment or historical or genetic or generational trauma attachment. We have literally worked our asses off just to be alive. through that experience. And mm-hmm. so when someone else says, well, I now identify as having this experience with this culture, it's very diminishing to us as individuals and as a people, because I get asked a lot about my my sexual anatomy in inappropriate conversations. And now you're going to take that as a badge of honor when you've never had that issue happen to you whatsoever, simply based on your skin and on your eyes. So it's very frustrating to feel like, yeah, there's a lot of things to be proud of. And there are a lot of things to be in awe and love and to see value in, but it's not yours to take.
Cultural identity theft.
I mean, it really is. And so it's frustrating because, you know, that happens quite a bit. And we want you to appreciate and see the beauty of, but also understand that it's not yours to own.
I like that.
That's great.
I think that explains it very well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know we asked, like, and this gets asked about you a lot, like, what do? Like, suicide prevention. You do a lot of different things. Can you just share with us a little more and listeners? I mean, like, you've written a few books. You're a public speaker. You do training programs.
We want you to brag on yourself for just
please.
A little bit.
Please talk about how awesome you are.
I don't know about that. I'm a hot mess. It's fine. So I really started doing volunteer work about probably eight or nine years ago in Hot Springs. And that's kind of what set me on this path of absolute just mistakes one after another. And now I'm here. So I went to an event or to a meeting and they said that suicide was a problem. And so I was very invested in that. I lost my father at a very young age and I can't even tell you how many people to that issue over the years. And so at some point someone asked me to stand up and do a presentation and I did what everyone else did at the time, which felt very ironic and also terrible, like death by PowerPoint and suicide prevention. I'll let that sit. Yeah, it just felt wrong to do that. Okay. So yeah, everyone's like, we're not saying it. She is. So I remember leaving that event thinking, I'm never doing that again. I'm never going to present again. I don't want to talk in front of anyone. This is terrible. And most of it had to do with the fact that it didn't feel like me as I was doing it. And so I spent a couple years learning about public speaking and really trying to educate myself on like, what's really engaging? How do you motivate people and how do you really connect with people versus just giving information? Mm-hmm. Because I want to give information, but I want to engage and I really want people to walk away feeling something, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So I spent time doing that. And so I got to where more and more people were asking me to do public speaking and presentations. So I have 4 or 5 pages of content that I've like just lists of things that I've built myself that are my programs that I offer. I do that all over the country at this point for any group that wants to pay for a public speaker to come.
Yes. And how would they do that? Do you have a website?
I do have a website and I have someone who's actually about to fix my website and he's a godsend and I adore him. And that will happen. But I do have a website, SusieReese.org. You can literally Google me and it pops up. It's weird, I know. So but it was frustrating too. It got to be frustrating in that I saw a lot of people who were motivational speakers who would charge however much, come in and then leave. And people had this feeling. They were motivated, right?
Something
if they're
sparked,
good, right? And then you leave and you leave them with nothing. And they're back at where they were before you came, except now they have less money in their bank account, right? And so for me, it got frustrating because I don't want to simply do that. I don't just want to come in and get you excited. I want to be able to actually do something to help. So I started digging into program development. And so I do a lot of different types of program development. I actually will work with an organization and sit down and hear what their needs are and be able to build them a training program if that's what they want for their organization, for their individuals. I've built peer support programming, crisis intervention training, train the trainer programming. Okay. I've done programming for school districts who are wanting to incorporate crisis planning into their organization. And so in a way that includes suicide and other components as well. I've built programs. tons and outpatient therapy programs and structure on how that could look for individuals, because that's where true change actually really begins to happen. Mm-hmm. So you want that motivational incident. You want someone to come in and get people fired up. Yeah. But then how are you going to actually do anything? And right. most of the time, these organizations are missing something, or they may even have process or protocol barriers that are keeping them from being able to truly impact change. A lot of our nurses are in systems that are not trauma-informed, mm-hmm. that are not truly supporting their well-being. And we have such a high rate of turnover there because of the trauma that is in existence in that space. Sure. And if we know that, that's a problem, why are we not addressing it? Mm-hmm. Why are we not doing something about it? Mm-hmm. So for me, that's where my heart really is impacting true change. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, as you know, it doesn't just happen overnight, right. and you cannot be impatient. And I'm an impatient person, and you have to really understand the organization, their needs, and what their goals are for their individuals as well. So I've been blessed to work with military groups, law enforcement groups, schools, I mean, you name it. And I probably have some type of experience in that, but people don't often know about that side because most of the time there's, you know, NDAs and all sorts of things associated with that. And I can't just tell people about what I'm working on, but that's really where I enjoy doing a lot of that work, because it makes it to where I have to really problem solve. And mm-hmm. I really have to understand these issues, which then in turn makes me a better public speaker on these issues, mm-hmm. because I understand them in a way that even though I'm not a teacher or even though I'm not an officer, I understand those barriers and I see what they're truly facing mm-hmm. in a way that others don't. So I get to kind of go behind the scenes, and a lot of times I get to have fun too. I've gone and done ride-alongs and shot weapons and painted colors, you know, with kids, and just, it's a very interesting life for me. And I get bored sometimes. That's good. It keeps me from being bored.
So since I'm a lobbyist, we always have some kind of discussion about advocacy. Have you ever done any advocacy or worked with the government? Or
most definitely. Yeah.
What'd you do?
A few things, actually. Whenever Act 420 was being put together, which was the Crisis Stabilization Unit Act, I was actually...
That was mine.
Was that?
Yeah.
kudos to you. I was working in Garland County at the time with Judge Schweitzer, the second Judge Schweitzer, and Mark Allen and some other individuals, and we were trying to have programming put into it as well. We actually met with Clark Tucker about it. But at that point, it was too far along to have any impact.
And we had then, the votes and we were going.
Oh, I know. Well, and hey, we definitely need. Votes.
We can amend it later.
We need more, right. we need to start with what we can get and then build in more later. But so I've done stuff like that. I've worked with different, you know, community leaders on different things. A lot of them will actually ask me for input on things that are being done or not being done. I know right now we really need better support for our first responders. They need to have guarantees that if they have mm-hmm. PTSD because of an incident that they experienced at work, that they're going to be able to access care, that it's not going to impact their jobs, and that mm-hmm. they will actually not be looked at any differently because they're human beings. And of course, those things are going to impact them.
Do you know about ARLEAP?
I do. Yes. Okay.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah. So it just depends on the day. My days are very different. I don't normally mm-hmm. have a standard. You know, yesterday I spent all day in front of a computer doing virtual mm-hmm. events. And the day before that, I was traveling and had been doing live speaking events. Mm-hmm. And so I've had quite a bit of speaking this week, but next week I'll be doing a lot more program development. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you have anything else, Jason?
I'm good. Do you have any questions that we missed?
Well, what's your favorite joke?
Of yours?
No. I mean, obviously. What's one of those things that you can just pop off whenever it's like when people are...
When people say Jesus Christ, I say, no, just call me Bradley. That's my favorite.
Oh. Well... On that note,
oh, are we ending there?
Yeah, I'll save mine for face to faces.
We're going to put a microphone in the corner and let you practice your act.
We'll do that next time. I would love to see you do that.
I have one that's so inappropriate. So
most people pitch their next show.
But I can't do it in front of my suicide prevention group. So maybe I can pitch it here.
Yeah, go for it. Let's do it.
Yes, I'm an Asian and I definitely get all A's except in my bra.
I love it.
I've been working on my content. Yeah,
I love it.
I can't do that in my suicide prevention. That's definitely not it.
It's totally okay here. We're used to that here. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I'm super excited that you're here, that we got to share some information. Hopefully we broke some stigma. Maybe some different topics.
Maybe we had some conversations that we were supposed to have.
And we should do it again.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we got to meet. Go check her out. Follow her on
everything. Southern Fried Asian, because I was Southern raised with a crispy Korean coating. I am the original recipe. I don't care what other half Koreans have to say about it. Although there are a few Northern Fried Asians, it's definitely not as good. So, Southern Fried Asian on Instagram. I'm on a lot of things that I'm not actively on. And then SusieReese.org.
Awesome. Thank you.
Oh, and Reese with a C, because Susie are cool.
Oh,
is it Susie with an S?
It's S-U-S-I-E. I know you want my phone number. I'll give it to you later.
Okay, but we're not giving that out over the air.
No, don't call
her. So anyway, don't call her. Go to her website. And if you are an organization, especially if you're a first responder, I definitely think you need to link up with her. And even some therapy practices that may need a little help addressing biases, racism, suicide prevention, all above.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks. Show me something else, I'm going insane.